Okay. I will now introduce myself as the 10-minute speaker. So, my name is Blythe. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is March 6, 2011. Last month, by the grace of God, I celebrated 7 years of continuous sobriety. I feel like I'm at Magic Mountain right now, and I'm on one of those free fall roller coasters. When I came in, everybody who knows when I came, I was very shy, and it was very difficult for me to even get up to the podium and read. So for me to be able to do this today is just a testament to this program changes you in a beautiful way that you're able to do things that you never thought you'd be able to do. And I've also been taught that in order to grow, I need to be uncomfortable. So I hope to do a lot of growing today. So I think for me, the moment I started drinking, I knew that I was an alcoholic. The moment I put alcohol into my body, I automatically wanted more. And I knew that it was not normal, because some of the other kids that I had started drinking with, they could have a couple drinks and be fine, and I wanted the vodka from the beginning. I remember the first time I got sick from alcohol, I was at a small get-together of friends when I was in high school, and we were drinking screwdrivers, and I went to the bathroom, I got sick, and I came back to the table and pretended like nothing happened, and I kept on drinking, and that was what we called the puke and rally. So I continued the puke and rally through my whole drinking career, because it was not an excuse for you to stop drinking because you got sick. You just kept going. And so I continued drinking through high school, and I always led this double life of, I had my friends, I made sure to try to get really good grades, because getting good grades was a ticket out of Visalia. I grew up in Visalia, and I was going to leave that town, and I was not ever coming back. But I also had my party friends, that I could just let loose and were like me and wanted to experiment. And so I had two different hats that I was constantly juggling, and two different masks I was putting on from a very young age. And it wasn't until I found this program that I actually learned that I could be the same person and I could be me all the time and feel comfortable. But so I ended up getting into college in Southern California, and I left, and I was like, see ya, I'm not coming back. And I was a freshman in the dorms, and I was young, and I developed an eating disorder. And in order to cope with that, I started taking diet pills, which were pretty much like legal amphetamines, and it really kicked up my drinking a lot. And I was, eventually it led me to really dark and demoralizing, it really kind of escalated my drinking career. And I ended up making it through college by the grace of God. I don't know how I did it. And ended up getting a job, and at that time, it was in Southern California. I got into real estate, and the market, it was when the housing market was big, and there was all my friends got into mortgage, and they were doing those really shady subprime loans and making a ton of money. So here we were, really young, making a lot of money, going to clubs, taking off to Vegas, the party scene was just insane. And I never knew what was going to happen. I never knew. It was like Russian roulette when I put alcohol in my body. All of a sudden, we'd jump in a car, I'd wake up in Las Vegas, party all night, go back to Newport. I was living in Newport Beach, and then all of a sudden, I'd have to be at work the next day. I just never knew what I was going to do when I was drinking. One time I decide, I go to a bar by myself. I always tell this story, and it's the insanity of my drinking is, I went to a bar by myself because I was bored and I was waiting for my friends, and I met a group of people that I had never met before, and they were going down to Mexico. And so I decide to go and pick up, go to my house and get a bag. And I told my one roommate that, who was an alcoholic, hey, I'm going to Mexico, and these are the people I'm going with, but if I don't come back, these are the ones you should look for. And it's like, in my brain, I knew that this was insane, an insane idea, but once I put alcohol into my body, all of my rationalization just went out the window. Go to Mexico, I'm fine. I come back, a couple months later, these people come up to me and they're like, we had such a great time in Mexico, it was so much fun. And I was like, I'm sorry, I don't remember who you guys are. And I was constantly putting myself in these really dangerous positions. And I was so reckless, I got to a point of, you know, I never tried to not be on this earth anymore, but if something happened, I didn't really care because alcohol and drinking was more important to me. Meanwhile, my family here in Visalia was just worried to death about me. And this one, you know, when I had to do my inventory and looking about my drinking, this one story kind of came to my mind of, it was Thanksgiving. I was probably around 23, 24, living in Southern California. They had these express jets that went from Long Beach to Fresno, and they were really short flights. They were like 45 minutes. And my mom was like, I'm going to book you one for Thanksgiving morning. Do you think you could make it to a 7 a.m. flight? And I was like, I am not in college anymore. Of course I can make a 7 a.m. flight. Well, my friends decide the Wednesday night before Thanksgiving, a lot of people get out and go to the bars, and they're like, we're going to do a pub crawl. Do you want to come? And so I was like, of course I want to come, but I have to stop drinking by midnight. So I pack all my stuff, and I think it's a good idea. If I have to stop at midnight, then I'm going to drink as much as possible before midnight as I can, taking shot, not having a drink, taking a shot at every bar we went to from 8 o'clock to midnight. That is the most drunk I've ever been in my entire life. I had alcohol poisoning. I was getting sick all night. My friends were so worried about me. They almost wanted to take me to the hospital. And they ended up waking me up, throwing me in the car, pretty much shoving me into the airport. I had the clothes on from the night before. I smelled disgusting. I get on the plane. I end up getting sick on a plane. This is like a 50-passenger plane, and the people hate me. And I get off the plane, and my mom looks at me, and it was like, you did it again. Like, I did it again. And I showed up, and I wasn't present for my family again. And all I wanted to do was just, I need to take a shower. I need to go to bed. I don't feel good. I can't help you make dinner. It was always about me. And not, maybe my family was happy to see me. They wanted to spend time with me. They wanted me to be involved in Thanksgiving dinner. But all I cared about was my using and drinking. And so that just was it for the next 10 years, just constantly not caring about consequences. I ended up losing my job. I got laid off, which after doing step work, realized I got fired. But I got laid off. And I didn't have a place to live. And so I thought, my mom was like, why don't you come back to Visalia? I've got a house. And I was like, God, I don't want to come back here. It's going to be like going to rehab. She's like, you can't drink in my house. You're already a mess. I was already having physical kidney issues and health issues from the drinking, and I was about 28 years old, so I was part of me was like, I can't believe I'm already having these issues and I'm not even 30 yet. So I stayed with my mom, ended up getting convinced by a therapist to get into AA, and I started working the steps and started working the program, and everything was, it was just, I didn't even think it would be possible to live life with alcohol. I thought, this is not something that people do. And when I walked in and I heard, I think I went to the Alano meeting, and it was Lawrence or somebody that was celebrating, I think, 20 years, Yeah, it was about 20 years, and I was 28, and I was like, holy crap, somebody's been sober for 20 years? How is that even possible? How are they happy? How are people laughing? How are they not raging lunatics? Like, that's, you know, they're just, and they have friends, and they have lives, and, you know, I saw the women who had careers and families and all these things that I hope to have someday, but I had no idea how to get there. And so I started doing the steps, and like one by one, you know, I started putting my life back together. Eventually got a job, eventually got in relationships, and you know, life just started happening. And, you know, looking back today, I'm like, I don't even know how I have 7 years of sobriety. I think it's just, it accumulates. You just do life, and you get little glimpses of like, wow, you know, life is really great. And then you just keep chugging, you know, the next thing comes. But I think I have a couple more minutes. I want to kind of talk about what my journey right now is about relationships. I'm really in gratitude for the type of friend and family member I get to be today. I had a coworker the other day pull me aside and tell me that I had been really crappy to her lately, a really crappy friend. And I, you know, a couple years ago, I would have been like, forget this. I don't need to listen to what you have to say. And so I sat there and I listened. It was her. She took my inventory. and some of the things she was saying was true. And the only thing I could say back was, I'm sorry you feel that way. And I could see on her face that it was, again, I was engaging in an old behavior of not acknowledging my part. And so I just prayed and was like, you're right. I have been really crappy. And I was like, that's not who I want to be today. And we talked it out, and we were able to move on from that. And it was, you know, it's such a blessing and growing experience. I have another friend in sobriety right now that has really opened my eyes to what it is to be a friend. And we get to learn about how different we are from some people, but how similar we are from this program. What people... Somebody I felt so different from is actually the same as me. It just looks different on the outside, the way that their character comes out and their, but you know, they get insecure and they get, you know, scared and they go into situations and their defects come up. And I learned that my defects come up as well. They just look different. And that has just been such a beautiful experience, growing from someone that you never would have dreamed you could grow, you know, with in the program. And I mean, today I have a relationship with my half sister. She was not in my life when I was drinking. We didn't grow up together, and I got sober and able to reconnect, and we have a great relationship. She lives in Chicago. I visit her a few times, and I get the blessing of having a sister. And today my dad, we didn't have a relationship when I came. Well, we did have a relationship when I came in, and I thought it was a great relationship. And so, until I started working the steps and realized I had an absence of emotional relationship. And I've got to walk through that and gotten to accept someone for the way that they are, exactly as they are, and not try to wish that they were different. And today, a couple Sundays a month, he comes over, I make dinner, and we get to hang out, spend time together. That's a blessing of the program. My mom and my relationship, we had a really rocky year. I'm telling you, this year has been a growing year of relationships. We, you know, had some major codependent issues, and, you know, there was a little bit of, how do I say this? You know, not everybody is in the program. You know, I'm in the program, and I have to work my side of the street of the program and let them live. The concept of live and let live, you know, I've really been learning that lately. And it's just all these, you know, I have some great sponsees right now who teach me stuff every single day. I never knew the value of sponsorship until I see myself in them, and I'm like, the lights go on, and it's such a blessing. You know, my sponsor used to always tell me, trust me, you do more for me. I'm like, how do I do more for you? You are helping keep me alive, and my sponsees do more for me, for sure. And this program was just, it restored, I'm just so happy that it has restored my family relationships, it's restored my sanity. I'm a productive member of society. I'm in this community today. And I do have to say that I'm so grateful that Rayanne asked me to chair, to warm up for her. You know, it was such a growing, it's been, I really enjoyed my friendship with Rayanne, and it has been, she's taught me a lot about myself and about how to be a good woman of integrity in this program. However, I do have to leave early after I introduce her because I have another service commitment up in Fresno. The young people, we started a young people committee here in Tulare County, and we've merged with Fresno County, and we're having elections, and this is a really big, it's a really big deal because this region hasn't really had a young people committee for a long time. And I've gotten, you know, I felt like I was being rude that I was going to leave early. And, you know, she was able to tell me, you know, you're leaving for another service commitment in Alcoholics Anonymous. You get to be of service and you get to help these other young people stay sober. So I'm excited that that's another adventure to go on. And I'm amazed that I can get up here and speak today. And I just want to thank you guys all here in Springville for having this meeting. It's a beautiful meeting, and the breakfast was amazing. So, thank you. So, it's after the break now, and I'm going to introduce the main speaker, who is Rayanne. And Rayanne has been able to be a part of my sobriety from day one and has, you know, able to be my friend and, a co-sponsor at times, and I've learned so much from her that I'm just eternally blessed to have her in my life. So, Rayanne.
Okay. I'm Rayanne, and I'm an alcoholic. And I didn't bring my stool, but I'm tall enough. My sobriety date is June 6, 1994, and my home group is the Tulare Tuesday Women Nights Amity Group, and I have a sponsor who has a sponsor who has a sponsor, and got that out of the way. And first, I'd like to thank Brett for asking me to chair today, speak, and for the delicious breakfast, thank you, and for my peeps for coming up. But most importantly, I want to thank Robert, if he's still in here, the newcomer, for coming. You are the most important person in this room. Thank you. And I hope you hear something that makes you want to come back. And if you don't, just keep coming back anyways. Yeah. I was born and raised in Fresno. Wait, I feel like I'm really loud. I was born and raised in Fresno, and I'm the youngest of three and the only girl. My dad's an alcoholic. My mom was a codependent, and later in life she started drinking a little bit heavier. She could have been an alcoholic. No one really knows. But my two older brothers were cool. They were, you know, drinking and smoking pot, and they had a lot of friends, and I thought they were cool. I was my dad's little girl. I was the apple of his eye, he said, and I learned how to manipulate him at a very, very young age. And I always felt, now my perception and my brother's perception is completely different. I always thought my dad paid attention to my brothers, always had doing things with them, and my brother said it was the opposite, that I was daddy's little girl, I was spoiled rotten, but I didn't see it that way. I felt like I was always trying to get his attention. So growing up in an alcoholic home and not knowing it was alcohol was the problem, I was told that my dad was allergic to alcohol, but I thought he was allergic like when you eat strawberries or shellfish and you break out in hives. No, he ended up in jail. And he was also a binge drinker, so I never got to see him drink at home. He would go out of town, and all I know is he'd come back and all his clothes would be thrown out in the front lawn or in the garage, and I was the kid that went and gathered them all and was mad at my mom for doing that to my daddy, you know, and putting it back. And I was a little kid when that was happening. I didn't understand what was it's like the elephant in the room. But I always felt different, like I didn't fit in. I've always been outgoing, you know, getting that attention, life of the party type person. But I never felt like I really belonged. There was something missing my whole life. And I didn't know what it was back then, but I knew when I was 12 years old and I drank alcohol, it took all that pain away. All those family problems of, you know, mom yelling at dad, you know, yelling back at mom, or him getting, doing something. I didn't know what the something was, but until I was about a junior, senior in high school, it was always just, it wasn't discussed. It wasn't talked about. I didn't have any role models in my house, for drinking. So when I put alcohol in my system, I became whoever I wanted to be. I was taller. I was beautiful. I had big boobs. I was smarter. You know, that's what alcohol did. It took away all the problems that I thought I had, or the difference, that filling up that hole inside of me. And not just alcohol. I did, like Blythe was talking too, you know, I did the drug scene. Did a lot of speed, because speed helps with losing weight. And I also have an eating disorder. But let me get back to alcohol. I can remember the first time I drank. I was not like just taking sips off my grandpa's beer or something like that. I'm talking drinking. You know, we played the game where I was spending the night at a friend's house and told my parents I was spending the night at someone else's house. You know, basically we spent the night at someone whose parents weren't home. And across the street, the kids were in high school, and they were having a party, and they had a bunch of booze there, and they had beer. And so, you know, me, I'm so tough, you know, 5-foot girl, is going to go over there and drink. And, you know, I was drinking a beer with them, and then they have these little shots, and I thought, well, why not? You're doing it. So I drank a bunch of shots, and all I remember was I blacked out, which I called blacked out, but I also passed out, which I called falling asleep until I got to this program. But I came to once or twice. I can remember marching in the street. My friends were marching me, and then I remember talking to my brother there, and that was it. And they told me I drank a lot in a short amount of time, and I was a mess. And the next day I had a track meet. My dad picked me up, and needless to say, I didn't do very well that day. So that was my first experience with alcohol. And then it just went from then. It was a Friday, Saturday night. Alcohol wasn't real hard for us to get as kids, because if our older brothers and sisters weren't buying it for us, we would pimp it out. Stand at a liquor store and pay a guy, you know, 10, 15 bucks. Back then, that was a lot of money. You know, we'll buy you a 12-pack if you buy us one. And I knew from the beginning I drank differently from my friends, but I kind of just put it back there. You know, because I didn't really know what was different, but I kind of, that can't be right. You know, because when I drank, most of the time I blacked out. Because when I put alcohol in my system, I can't stop. I keep drinking and drinking and drinking until I fall asleep. And so that was what it was like on Friday and Saturday nights. And a lot of my story has part of drugs in it. But it was mainly because of to lose weight. Because I always felt like, well, let me back up. Growing up in my house, I had to be the perfect child. That's how I saw it. My two older brothers were kind of screwed up. And so I was the one that, you know, this is their last resort. And so, and only the only girl, you know, I did everything they wanted me to do. I danced. I rode horses. I got good grades. You know, I was captain of the church, pep girls. I did everything they wanted me to do, trying to always please them. You know, and it never worked. And so that led into just my whole life. I was going to please you so you will like me, because I couldn't handle someone not liking me. But when I drank alcohol, that went away. But I was also told, you know, in our house, if your outside look perfect, then life's good. Because you didn't know what's going on in our house, you know, that we were all dying inside, but the outside looked good. That's how I was taught from my appearance. So I had to be perfect. I had to have the perfect friends. I had to have the perfect weight, the perfect clothes. You know, my clothes were always ironed and starched. I can wear a wrinkled shirt today, you know. So those are some of the reasons why I drank a lot, because I just didn't feel, I felt different, couldn't fit in. And like I said, high school was Friday and Saturday nights, and then I couldn't drink on Sundays. I was born in I'm Catholic, and I went to Catholic schools for 12 years in Fresno, and I had this thing that I couldn't drink on Sundays. And, because that's the day you go to church, right? And put on your Sunday go to meeting clothes, and you just don't drink on Sundays. Why? Later in life, about a senior in high school, I realized that's when all the Catholics drink is on Sundays. I didn't realize that. So I gave up that then. So then it became Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And I like the fact that I realized when I was in high school that the best way to take care of a hangover is just to drink again. And so I would, you know, drink. And a lot of it was just beer because that was easier for us to get. I was sitting in a meeting a couple weeks ago, and this girl was talking about hiding her alcohol from her parents. Because I always said I didn't hide my alcohol from my husband or anything like that. Well, I did a little bit. I'll get to that later. But I thought, oh, my God, I did when I was in high school. I used to take the bottles, if we got bottles, and I put them in the back of my car or, you know, beer, and they'd be hot. Ugh. But we'd still drink them with a straw. You know, and I did, and sometimes I'd take it into the house. I did hide it from my parents, so I did hide alcohol. You know, yay. Anyways, so I drank more than my friends. I was a pig when I drank. I really tried to be a lady when I drank, but I didn't. I wanted more, more, more. I could never get enough. And, you know, we'd pimp that 12-pack, and I'd say, we have to have two, and let some of them have, you four girls can drink that 12-pack, and I'll drink this. And for a little person, I could put a lot of alcohol in me. And like I said, I couldn't stop. I didn't know where that point is to stop. And I just blacked out and fell asleep. Sometimes that was good, and a lot of times it wasn't. I'd have to ask my friends, you know, hey, what did I do? You know, or because that was really hard to ask. So usually I would kind of just say, oh, yeah, we had a really good time. And they say, oh, yeah, remember you did this? I'm like, oh, yeah. Clueless. I didn't remember. Didn't remember a thing. I remember one time I woke up with gravel stuck to my face, and I had fallen straight down after guzzling straight vodka, because they told me I couldn't do that. You know, that was me. Don't tell me I can't do it, because I'm going to do it. And so anyways, I went to Fresno State. I was kind of bribed about, my dad kind of bribed me, so I stayed home and went to Fresno State, and I joined a sorority. And one more time I'm thinking, okay, I've got 40 girls, I'm going to find friends here, they're going to be my friends. And I did have friends, but I just didn't feel like they were good friends. I don't know, I was missing, there was missing something, and I didn't know what that something was. So now I'm going to join the sorority, and I'm going to have 40 new girlfriends, and I'm going to fit in. And it didn't take long before I was partying over at the fraternity parties. And, Friday night, Monday night after meetings, I was over at the fraternities, and so drinking. And so it became Monday, Thursdays, Fridays, Saturdays, and probably Sundays just to get rid of the hangover. And that's what I did during college. And then it became, you know, sometimes during the week, too. I did, one story I did. When I drank, I also got, like, fearless. And did really stupid things, which I thought they were fun at the time. And I didn't get in trouble when I was in high school. My friends would spend the night at my house, and they'd be getting sick, and my parents would be getting on their case. Yet our house was the house to go to, because I had the cool parents. Even though they didn't let us drink, they were cool. Don't ask me how, because I didn't think they were cool. But they'd be getting sick, and I'd get away with it. I'd be sitting on the bed with bedspins, going, please don't let me throw up. Please don't let me throw up. But one time I decided that I was going to make the pizza man laugh. So I took off all my clothes and put a 12-pack of Coors Light box on my head. And when he rang the doorbell, I jumped out in front of him like this. He didn't laugh, and he just stood there. I was just mortified. I'm like, come on, this is funny, right? And I took off. I mean, that's the kind of stupid things I do, or marching down the street taking my clothes off. I don't know. And I've been told I would dance on tables. Okay, a couple times. I can remember one time doing that. But, you know, they'd hold the table, and we'd get up on them, or benches. And I blacked out and didn't find out. In college, I was drinking more often. One story that I will tell about my college days was that one of the fraternities was having a fundraiser, and the fundraiser was to see how many shots of beer you could drink in an hour. And so I'm going, oh, this is right up my alley. I love this. So I was telling people, yeah, I can probably drink, you know, maybe 10, maybe 20 shots in an hour of beer, no problem. So I was getting people giving me a dime, a quarter, you know, a dollar. It's like, yeah. So that night, I was the first one to the table. I was ready to go. And it was, they were, it was in a square, and I can remember I was sitting at one corner, and the other, at the diagonal, was the keg. And on the table, they had pitchers of beer and little shot glasses. And so they said, go, and bam, I went, and I started drinking, you know, just scooping it out of the pitcher. Next thing I remember, they moved the keg around to me, and they put a couple of pitchers in front of me. I think I did 20 shots about the first 5 minutes. And that night, I ended up drinking 121 shots. In an hour of beer, and that's 11 beers. And I halfway, sometime, I don't know, I blacked out. But someone, not someone, the gentleman is related to me now by marriage. We went outside and he stuck his finger down my throat, and all his beer just came out. I can remember kind of doing that and then sitting back down. And this girl next to me was mad because I won. No one was close to what I was. They were still like in the 90s. And she was mad and said, I shouldn't have been able to do that. You know, I was like, oh, you know, I don't remember anything. But I got my name on the plaque and I won. But they changed the rules after that. And I think now I got, oh, my God, I could have died. I could have gotten alcohol poisoning. That was like a 2-day hangover. But that's the kind of stupid stuff I would do. I liked the attention. And that's what, you know, that's what I got. And I didn't go ask people for their money afterwards. I was embarrassed that I drank that much. Let's see, after college, I graduated from Fresno State, and I was headed to law school up north, and law school really isn't something I really wanted to do. It was something I was told I would be good at, and that I kind of like, that's what I was told I was supposed to do since I was in grammar school, and when it finally came down to it, I didn't really want to do it, and so I head up to law school, and at the same time, my brother was headed to Wisconsin for dental school, and so my parents went with him to help him get his apartment, all that stuff, and I'm thinking, okay, see, he's more important. One more time, he's getting the attention. I'm not getting the attention, so I had to go all by myself, you know, and get an apartment, and we're started at the same time, and I was there a week, and knew this is not what I wanted to do. I did not want to do that. But in my family, you don't quit. We are not quitters. You either stick it out or you just stick it out. You know, you don't quit. And I was, like I said, I idolized my dad, though. Even though, you know, he was the alcoholic and my mom was the codependent. And I was always mad at my mom. I treated my mom horribly. I said things to her that no one should ever say to anyone, let alone your mother. And so, but I always blamed her for my dad, because I didn't understand. And then, so I didn't want to disappoint my dad. It's like, you know, I'd rather die than have to tell him I'm quitting. That's how bad it was. So I decide, I get this idea, okay, I'm going to drop out of law school. And so I felt like I needed to, I'm 21 years old, and I felt like I needed to call my parents to tell them, get their permission, you know. And I called, and they were back in Wisconsin, and I told my dad I was dropping out, and what I heard was, you're a loser, you don't quit, give it a month. He swears that's not what he said, but that's what I heard. And then my mom got on the phone, and this is a God moment, and she said, nothing is worth taking your life. She knew that somehow that I was thinking that. I don't know how, but that is a God moment for me, because I would rather die than have to face them to tell them that. And at least it was in a phone call. I didn't have to face them face to face. So the next day, I went and dropped out of law school, and I did my three favorite things. I was up in Sacramento, so I went and smoked cigarettes, drank beer, and bet on the horses. And I did that all day long, and at about, I don't know, 4 or 5 o'clock, I realized, oh my God, my life is over. I just dropped out of law school. I have no plan B. And I always had, you know, I was organized. I mean, really, like, insanely organized. And I had ABC, I'm going to do this, 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 and this. And if this happens, I'll do this. And if that happens, you know, I had no backup plan. I'm done. You know, I'm a loser now because I just dropped out of law school and I have no plan. And, you know, I'm picturing myself just being a bum and, you know, just living at home until I'm 40 or something. I don't know. I couldn't see past that. So I called the guy I was dating at the time. And I said, you know, I dropped out of law school and I don't know what to do. And he goes, well, why don't you come home? I can't. I'm drunk. Take the train. Oh, okay. So I took the train home. And, of course, I drank on the way home. And he picks me up at the train station and he says, I said, what am I going to do? My life is over. I've got to have a job. I got to do something. And he says, well, why don't you become a teacher? And I wanted to kill him. Instead, I married him. But because the teachers in my family were fat, mean, and dowdy. And I was not going down that route. And I did. And so anyway, so I started. And then I said, I married that guy. And, you know, Fresno is not really a big town. But I went from Fresno to Corcoran. And that's like hitting the brick wall. I mean, there's just like nothing there, and it's very small. And so I'm thinking, one more time, here it is. I'm going to have new friends, and these people are going to like me, and blah, 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 blah. And I'm going to fit in. And it didn't take long, again, the only reason why I have my job is because so-and-so knew so-and-so, because my mother-in-law knew them. The only reason why they're being nice to me is because they're David's friends. The only reason why they like me is because I married this family. That thinking came back so fast. I was so insecure. I never thought anything, you know, I could do anything. Also, on the other side of that is I blamed everybody. It was always everybody's fault. It was never my fault. How could it be? Look at me. I'm 5 foot and I'm cute. And by the way, don't call me cute. When I was growing up, that's what everyone used to always say. They said, oh, you're so cute. You know, I wanted to date my brother's friends, but it was kind of like an unwritten rule somewhere, they said. I couldn't date them. They would always say, I'm cute. And I hated that. And I mean, before I got sober, I was like ready to punch you in the face if you called me cute. I've kind of come to grips with it today, but anyways, there's kind of a joke in Corcoran, or a little saying that says, you either have a really good marriage or you drink. Well, I drank my first 5 years of marriage, and I was starting to drink every day. I didn't realize, I wasn't getting drunk every day, but I was drinking every day. We had, and this is the part where I talk about hiding the alcohol. We joined, there was a bunch of us young couples, and we joined the Wine of the Month Club. And back then it was, you know, wine, hog, snob, although I think it's still in again because my brother-in-law has cases and cases of wine. But we would join and have these parties where, you know, we'd bring out a bottle of wine or two or three. And I'm telling you, I wasn't drinking for, you know, the taste of the wine. I wanted the effect, you know. And so we had all this wine, and I would make dinner when I used to make dinner, although I am making dinner again nowadays. But what I would do is I would drink a glass of wine while I was making dinner, and my husband might have a glass at dinner, and then I might have another glass. And then he'd go to bed early because he had to get up really early. So what I'd do is I'd take that wine, I'd drink that down, go out to the garage, get one, the same one, and drink that down to where I thought we had drank it. Put the other one in a bag and put it in the trash outside. So I guess I was hiding my alcohol. But thing is, I didn't realize I was doing that until I got sober. You know? In Corcoran, there was four pizza parlors. And that's kind of like where we hung out, is the pizza parlors. And we played sports, volleyball, usually volleyball, and then a group of us, and then we'd go down and drink beer afterwards. And I started having kids, and my 3-year-old son was with me my last drunk. I had a 3-year-old and a 1-year-old at the time, and my son came down with me to the pizza parlor because I was going down for 2 beers. And next thing I know is we were playing the liar's game with the dollars. And you lie about how many twos and threes and all that is. And And I kind of came to, and I looked over, and I saw my son. He was making pizza boxes with the owner. He's 3 years old. He's making pizza boxes with the owner. I said, he's good, right? And then came to again, and I was sitting across. And when I first started, there was two benches of tables, or people full of two benches worth of people sitting there. And when I came through at the end, woke up, there were the two known town drunks across from me. And I just felt like crap. That was like, oh my God, this is what my life has amounted to. And let me back up a little bit here. About 8 years prior to me getting sober, my dad and brother had gotten sober. My dad had actually started getting sober since 1960. And I didn't know about it. My mom would take us somewhere and we'd wait for an hour. He was in a meeting because he'd lost his license. She had to take him. And she had to put us in the car. Didn't know that, you know. Didn't know that he was trying to get sober since way back then. Lost my train of thought. So they get sober, and they do this Bloody Thursday or whatever at this rehab place, and it's where you kind of get to attack the drunk and let them know how they affected your life. But they also had counseling, their family therapy, and they found out our part, you know, because everybody in an alcoholic family has some type of a part that you play or whatever you get labeled as. Well, anyways, at that time, I decided that because of the things I was doing, people pleasing, trying to just be perfect and just always unhappy and just always blaming someone else. I mean, I hated you because, you know, I hated myself and I didn't know what to do. And so I started going to therapy And in my family, it was very apparent that they knew I had an eating disorder. Besides all the, you know, the drugs that I was doing to keep the weight off. And I don't even know if they have cross tops and pink hearts anymore. Those were my favorites. And, you know, and like Blythe said, diet pills, that was free. I mean, not free, but it was easier to get. You know, and I did a lot of cocaine, but that is a completely different story. And so I was abusing exercise, and I was just crazy about it. And it was very apparent in my family. And I knew that that was really, really out of control. And in fact, I took that test about 7-8 years. Are you an alcoholic? And I can remember lying. I didn't, just in case I wasn't one. I didn't want anybody to, you know, think I was. And then I didn't, because my brother and dad had gotten sober and they had all these friends and they were laughing and they were having sober parties in our backyard. And they were different people. So I knew there was something was up, and I didn't really understand it. I just wasn't ready to say I was an alcoholic. So I went, you know, 7 more years. But then that night when I was sitting there and I woke up or came to and the two town drunks, and I just felt horrible. I was just felt little, just ugh. I knew I was going to an eating disorders hospital a day or so later. And so I just knew, this is it. I can't do this anymore. And then the next thing I know, I woke up and I was at home. And I didn't didn't know how I got home. I jumped up, ran to my son's bedroom. He was okay. He was in bed. Didn't have any scratches on him. I went outside. The car was parked perfectly. I didn't know if I drove home or if my husband came pick me up or if someone drove me home. And then I just went back to bed, and I was just shaking. I was just completely shaking and knew I'm done. I can't do this anymore. And I was starting to get the DTs. I wanted to die. I did not know how to raise these kids. No one gave me a book, and I wasn't going to raise them the way I was raised. And I was doing exactly what my parents were doing. You know, and I wanted the chain to be broken. I knew a little bit because I used to sit in those meetings for 7-8 years and hear those people talk, hear you guys talk about, you know, what it was like to be sober. But all I could focus in on were the war stories, the things that you guys did that were funny. I didn't listen to the part when you worked the steps or anything like that. I wasn't ready for it. So finally, at that point, I knew I was done, so I went into this eating disorders hospital as an anorexic bulimic, and I came out an alcoholic. And that was the best thing I ever did. And while I was there, I only stayed 2 weeks because I was afraid they asked this question, have you ever tried to commit suicide? Have you ever had thoughts of committing suicide? I was like, I am not telling them. I watched One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest one too many times. And I thought they were going to put me in that straitjacket. And I was like, nope, I'm not telling you. And so they kicked me out. I wasn't bad enough. If I had gone to alcohol rehab, they probably would have let me stay. Doesn't matter. You know, I stayed 2 weeks. It was long enough. Because after that first week, I had come clean with everything. I knew that if I wanted any chance at life, I had to come clean with everything. And I did. And I can remember my parents coming down after about, well, it was probably that first weekend. And they were just like, oh, you're not an alcoholic. You're copying your brother. You have always copied your brother. You're not an alcoholic. And that was my mom. And my dad goes, nah, you're not. And it pissed me off. And I'm trying to convince them that I'm an alcoholic, right? No, it's just about the food. It's just, you know, da, 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 da. There was a counselor there, and it was right before I left. I just got this panic attack. I said, oh my God, I have to do this for the rest of my life. How am I going to do this for the rest of my life? And this lady was like me. She not only had eating disorder problems, but she also was an alcoholic. And she told me, you know what? You only have to do it one day at a time. And right now you only have to do it 1 hour, or maybe it's just 1 minute. And she calmed me down, and she spoke about that and told me her story. And I was like, ah, I'm okay. You know, I'm going to be okay. Well, I get out of this place, and it's a Saturday night, and the first thing I do is I told my husband, I got to go to a meeting. And so I went to, it was a candlelight meeting at the, I believe it was at the methadone clinic in Tulare. And there was a gentleman in there that had a business in Corcoran that I kind of knew him, but he knew me. And he said, welcome, I'm glad you're here. And I was like, oh, this isn't so bad. And David Looper was there. And he scared me because he talked so loud and he hit his hand on the table. And I was like, ugh. But that was my start, my journey. I started doing AA, NA, and OA meetings that first 30 days. That was almost impossible for me to do. I got a sponsor because you told me to get a sponsor. And this first sponsor that I got, nice lady and everything. I just, you know, I met with her one time, and I remember my dad calls me and says, at this time my dad's sober again. And he's saying, well, how's your sponsor? How are you guys doing? Oh, I'm fine. I go, you know what, though? I haven't talked to her, Dad. She hasn't called me. And he goes, she's not going to call you, stupid. You know? And I didn't get it. So through a series of events, I ended up getting this other sponsor, and that's the sponsor I have today. And I love that woman. She's a wonderful person is what she is, and she's exactly what I needed. You know, God put her in my life for a reason. And so anyway, she taught me that when I got her, I had to release my other sponsor with love. And I'm like, huh? I don't get that. In other words, I had to go tell my first sponsor, thank you for helping me, but I'm moving on type. And I was scared. I was like, I am not doing it. She said, well, I'm not going to sponsor you then until you do. I'm like, oh. But I did it. She taught me how to do it. And, you know, that lady, she was very kind. And she goes, no worries. It's okay. It doesn't always work out. And my sponsor told me that's a sign of someone having a good program. You know, they're not going to say, well, good luck. You know, that's what I thought. You were going to write me off, and that was it. So I started working the steps with my sponsor, Evie, and she scared me. She really scared me. But I was also desperate, and I wanted this program, so I would have done just about anything. But she pulled my cover. We are probably really just two opposites, but yet we have alcoholism in common. And I love what she has. I love her program. She has peace of mind. Of all the stuff that she has gone through, that woman has serenity and peace of mind. And that's, to this day, I still want that. You know, I want what she has, so I keep doing what she's doing. Steps 1, 2, and 3 were, I don't know, I don't want to say they were easy for me, but they were quick. You know, we talked about how my life was unmanageable and how I was insane, you know, and I told her some of the things that I did. And then, you know, we talked about God. Well, heck, I grew up Catholic. I know who God is. duh, you know. And so 2 and 3 were pretty easy. Can I give my life over to this God? Sure, I've been doing it all my life, so I thought, you know. My God growing up was a punishing God. The nuns told me I was, because I was probably ADHD as a child, and so I drove those teachers nuts. That's why I love my little ADHD kids. You know, I get them. And so I was always gonna, you know, I was always in trouble, so for talking. You know, I was always constantly talking. I guess I do a good job at that. And so I always thought I was going to hell. And any of these thoughts that I had, I was going to hell. So what the heck? By the time I was in third grade, I wasn't going to be a nun anymore, you know. And so the third step, even though I turned my care and life over to the care of God, it still took me a long time in sobriety to really know what that meant and what God really means to me. My God today is different. It's a lot different. And especially in the last 3 or 4 years, He is, I call him He, I call him God, my higher power, my creator. He's completely different even now, because I'll get to that story in a minute, but I lost that connection for a while, and it was a very scary place. So anyway, so then she had me do step 4, and you know, in the rooms I kept saying, ooh, step 4, ooh, scary, right? And so I'm scared, and I'm the type of person, I need deadlines, so she would say, okay, you will be done by this date. And by the way, she lived, for those of you that think that you have to have a sponsor right with you all the time, my sponsor lived an hour away from me, but I would call her, and I still, to this day, after 23 years, I still call her every Sunday. Except I called her yesterday because I knew I was speaking today and I was a little nervous. So she had to tell me not to lie and get on with it, basically. But I've called her for, you know, 23 years every Sunday. But what I would do is I would go out to her house and she would give me her assignment. And I'd go home and I would work on that assignment. I'd go back. We'd work out that assignment. We'd talk. We'd do other stuff. I'd spend, you know, the afternoon out there. And then she'd give me another assignment. I'd go home. And in between, I would call her. You know, those first 30 days, she made me call every single day. And I'm like, why? She goes, because you'll trust me later. You'll understand. She did a lot of that. Trust me. You'll understand later. And I'm like, no, I want to know now. You know, and she'd laugh at me just like that. She'd laugh. You'll find out later. It's none of your business right now. And so that 4-step, you know, I wrote it out. And she goes, now I want you to find out your part in this. I'm like, what? You mean I have a part? How dare you tell me that? And that was the beautiful thing about this, is that, you know, I trusted my sponsor enough that she knew what she was doing, and I wanted what she had, so I found my parts in those. Some of them I didn't, she had to help me with. I didn't, you know, I still relatively knew. By the way, I was going to have all 12 steps done in 6 months. That didn't work. The overachiever did not come out anymore in that. It took me a while to get my, I actually finished them within a year, but I was going to have them done real quick. And didn't work that way. And so then, you know, she goes, now you get to tell me your 4-step. Or you can, if you choose, you can go talk to a priest or somebody else. I said, oh, no, you're the one. You already know stuff. You're it. You know, and so I shared my 5th step with her. And that was such a relief to get all that stuff that was in here for so many years out to somebody else and have her not judge me and still love me. You know, and through my crying and through my whining, and, you know, she still loved me and she hugged me and told me it's going to be okay. You know, and after the 5th step, you know, I got to do 6 and 7. And I still have to do 6 and 7 today because, you know, I think about, I have these character defects, and some of them have kind of melted away and new ones have popped up. And, you know, one that I really didn't have growing up was jealousy. I really was not a jealous person growing up, but when a couple years back, that just popped up and reared its head, and it's like, wow, I am really a jealous person. And I had to work on that and let that go. So anyway, so I do 6 and 7, and then it's 8, and I have to make a list of all the people I have harmed. I'm like, wait, now you want me to say I'm sorry to them? And she goes, no, you make amends to them. I didn't understand the difference between saying I'm sorry and making an amends. I said I'm sorry all of the time, and I never meant it. And with my amends, I meant it. And then 10, 11, 12, those are the maintenance steps. You know, I'd love to say I do a 10th step every night. I don't. You know, I think about, I might think about, okay, what did I do today that my stomach's not feeling good, or I can't sleep tonight? What happened today that something's my part in here? I got to figure it out. You know, I go through periods of time where I'll journal every morning or every evening, you know, or I'll meditate for a longer period of time. Oh, speaking of meditation, the first time I had to meditate, my sponsor told me to put myself in the closet and turn off the lights and set the timer for 5 minutes. That was the longest 5 minutes of my life. I was like, I can't do this. I'm like, nah. You know, today I can actually be still for 30 minutes and just let go. That was really hard for me to do. My mind always went. I felt like I always had to be doing something. That was the way I was raised. You know, you don't sit on your butt. You're up doing something. You're either volunteering for something or you're just doing. And so anyway, in step 11, you know, prayer and meditation, that has really evolved since I've gotten sober. You know, I had to ask my sponsor, I don't know, it was months, it wasn't years, but in months, ask her, you know, how do you pray? I knew all the rote prayers. I could say all those, but I didn't feel like I was praying. How do you pray? And my prayers were, oh, God, help me out of this, you know. And she taught me how to pray. There's also another gal, Sue Noonan. She's passed away, and she took me up on a spiritual journey one time retreat. Thank you. A retreat. And she sat me down, and we sat there and we talked about how we don't ask God to do things for us. We thank Him for what He has done for us. That if we have, you know, something that we're scared or nervous, we let it go, we give it to Him, you know, and let Him decide what He's going to do with it. And, you know, we just do the footwork for it and let it go. I wish I could say I'm perfect at that too. And no. And meditating, like I said, I went from not being able to sit in the closet for 5 minutes to where I can be still for 30 minutes or even longer. It depends. And I can be somewhere. I can be in my own classroom. I used to be able to do this. My kids were driving me nuts. And I could just sit there and in my head do the serenity prayer over and over and just let it pass. And then so I didn't yell at one of those kids for doing something, you know. And then step 12, you know, being a service, going out, I was told from a very, you know, early on that I can't keep this unless I give it away. So that means, you know, sharing at meetings, speaking at meetings, sharing one-on-one with somebody, you know, just being there for somebody, basically. You know, my life today is wonderful. It really is. But a couple of years ago, it was very tough. Now, that's some of the things that I had to go through. 7 years ago this month, my mom passed away. Now, I have to back up. My mom and I's relationship for most of my life was just horrible. I blamed her for everything. She was just the meanest person on earth. But if you talk to anybody else, she was the most loving and giving person. But we just never clicked. And so she about 3 years prior to her dying, it just finally kind of clicked with me. My sponsor said, look, this is who she is. You either accept it or just eliminate it. Actually, it was ACE. Accept it, change it, or eliminate it. And I couldn't change my mom. You know, I couldn't eliminate her. So I just had to accept her for exactly who she was. And I found out she was the most beautiful, loving, giving person. Yeah, she had her faults, don't we all? You know, she loved me so much, she didn't want me to be like how she was raised. She wanted better for me, but I didn't see it as that. So those last 3 years of her life, she became my best friend. She was, you know, I had missed out on so much, but I don't regret that today. Because I had 3 really good years with her. And then she had a disease called lupus. And through a series of events, she got very, very ill. And she was in the hospital. She took a turn for the worse. And she was in the hospital, and she was not coherent anymore. And for a week, I was there day and night by her side. In fact, I crawled up in bed with her. Now, that might sound a little weird, but there was a woman in this program who lost her mother. Actually, she was my first sponsor. Then she lost her mother a few years prior for me to losing mine. And she talked about how her mom was unconscious, and she held her hand, and she crawled up in bed with her and hugged her mother. And that's exactly what I did. And the doctors just kind of looked at me, and my brother, who is in the medical field, kind of just looked at the doctor and said, well, she can't kill her, you know, like, let her do it, you know. And my mom's sister and myself, we sat there and we talked and talked to my mom about my mom, and people came and go. And I'll tell you what, when AA found out my mom was in the hospital, I was surrounded by AA people. And I also reached out to people because I knew I couldn't do this by myself. I was scared, you know. And yet there was a part of me that was so at peace to be able to stay there with her and watch her go through this. And finally, you know, she passed away, and I was there, me and her sister and I. And, you know, I watched her take her last breath. And I'll tell you what, that was the best experience, most powerful experience I've ever had in my life. And I got to do that because I was sober. And if I wasn't sober, I would have not been there. I would have missed it. I would have missed, you know, those 3 years prior. It's never too late, you know, to form those relationships with anybody you feel like you can't. And then, so with that being said, my dad and brother started drinking again. My dad had, my dad drank prior to that. He went out after 15 years, and then my brother went out after 19 years. And so I was pissed. I was pissed because they got to drink. They got to take their pain away, and I couldn't. I had to walk through this pain. And I was not a very loving person at the time. I was not turning my will over to God. I was mad. And so I just wanted to do something naughty. I just wanted to be bad. You know, I just wanted to be bad. I'm tired of people like, you know, the good wife, you know, everything being so, you know, as people say, oh, you know, you're so strong. You handled your, you know, you're in charge now of your family. You know, you got to help your dad and brothers. And it's like, no, I don't want to. You know, I wanted to be a rebel. So what I did is I got a tattoo. And that's not bad, except for the fact that my husband hates tattoos. And he really, really didn't want me to get one, but I did anyway, so that was me being bad, you know. And I was just saying and doing things that just were not me, that were me because I was doing them, but I didn't like it, you know. And I went through 3 years of this, and I couldn't find that connection again with my higher power. I felt like I was distanced, like there's just something not right. Well, it's because I was in self-will. You know, and I lost that connection, and I was doing everything I could. And a lot of things happened. My youngest had moved out, so we were empty nesters. My mom had died. My dog had died. My sponsor's husband died, and that was my mom's cousin. And then she moved. How dare her move on me? She moved from Helm, if you know where Helm is, it's like hell, Helm, California, over to Morro Bay. And I'm like, and she tells me that she's getting rid of all her sponsees. Well, there's only two of us, but she's getting rid of us, and that we have to go find new sponsors. And I'm like, no, you can't do this. I was pissed again. How dare you do this to me? You know, and I, you know, I found another sponsor, and it worked for a while, but it just wasn't, it wasn't right for me, and I still called her every Sunday, even during those two years. And finally, I said, I'm miserable, and blah, 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 blah. I go, why can't you sponsor me? She goes, oh, I'll sponsor you if you want. All you had to do is ask. Like, you told me. She goes, that was 2 years ago. I'm like, ah, you know. So I have her today, thank God. But so anyways, time passes, and then about, well, it'll be 2 years now, or is it 3 years? Gosh, I can't even remember. But my dad, who after my mom's death, that was his life, was my mom. And so he started really drinking heavy. Like I said, I never saw my dad, even during the time afterwards, I never saw him drink. He was a binge drinker. And I saw him drunk when I was 18 years old. Other than that, I still hadn't seen him drunk or anything. They still kept it from me. But I got the aftermath. You know, my mom said, oh, your dad lost his car last night. He went out drinking. And so, you know, I, for years, Dad, I'm going to get you sober. You watch, Dad. I'm going to be the child that does it. So I'd go to meetings with him and go help him find his car and just crazy stuff. For years, I, you know, tried to get my dad sober. Really, I can't do it. So he ended up in the hospital and at St. Agnes, and my very good friend who's in the program, my childhood friend and grew up with him since first grade, he calls me and says, hey, your dad's in the hospital, and he's in, I guess it was diabetes or something. He goes, hey, Ryan, I'm just going to tell you, and by the way, this kid, my dad helped him when he got sober and moved back to Fresno. And he said, your dad continues this, he's going to be dead within a year. And I'm like, and that's when I just kindly threw up my arms again one more time and said, what do I do? And prior to that, that connection, that losing that connection with my higher power got really, really low and really dark. You know, I didn't want to drink, but I wanted to blow my head off because I didn't want to feel any more pain. I just didn't want to deal with life anymore. And I got that call, and I realized that my dad's got to live his own life. I can't do this anymore. It's just driving me crazy. And so I told him, I said, Dad, I love you. I will always be your daughter. I will always love you. You've got to do what you got to do, but I can't watch you drink yourself to death. And basically almost a year to the day, almost, he was found dead because he took pills and alcohol and didn't nut, so he OD'd. And, you know, this may sound really shallow or hard, but it was a relief when he died for me, because I didn't have to wait anymore for that phone call that says, oh, your dad hit somebody and killed somebody, or your dad, you know, dead. He was finally at peace. His pain, like my mom's pain was over, his pain was over too. He just could never find this program. After that, I found my higher power again. I just realized I had to be out of my self-will, that I had to do God's will. And that's what this whole program is about. I have really two emotions, fear and love, and I act out of either one of them. It's either I'm going to act out of fear or I'm going to act out of love. And it's a lot easier to act out of love than it is fear. But I still have to, you know, prove to myself. And that's why, you know, the newcomer, if you're fairly new, you know, thank you for being here, because I need to remember what it's like out there. You know, that scary place. And I also, you know, thank you for praying for the alcoholic who still suffers in and out of this room, because I was one of those suffering. I was going to meetings. I was talking to my sponsors, but I wasn't sharing everything, you know, because I was embarrassed. I had 17 years sobriety at the time. No one's supposed to act like that, you know, and I still want to know what act like that means to this day. But in the last 2 years, though, since my dad's death, though, I have been able to really come back and work this program with a vengeance. You know, I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love what it has done for me and for others. You know, not everybody gets it, and some people have to die for us to live, and that's just the truth. You know, I love being in service. I have been in service since early sobriety, because my sponsor told me that's going to help me keep sober. And it's not that I have to do it or I need to do it, is I get to do it, and I want to do it today. You know, just from simply taking someone, picking someone up for a ride to go to a meeting, or just someone to sit on the phone with and talk to things. I know in Corcoran, we had an AA meeting going on, and it was the only one in my, about 7 years sober. My sponsor says, you know what? I think it's about time you get back to your community. So I started an NA meeting there and a Spanish-speaking AA meeting, because it was a great need for it. And they went for, you know, a long time. I left after about a year because, you know, those were God's meetings. They weren't my meetings. You know, and sad to say, there are no meetings left in Corcoran. The gentleman that used to run it passed away about 2 years ago, and nobody has taken it. I always say I will never be a treasurer again because I was treasurer in Corcoran for 7 years. I said, I'm never doing that job again. But if I was asked to, I would do it because that's what I was told. That when someone in AA asks me to do something, being of service, that's what you're supposed to do. There's two lines in the big book that, not lines, but parts of the book that I love. And the first one is, faith without works is dead. And I heard a speaker say, and that's always been my favorite saying in the big book. And I had a speaker who said, work without faith is dead too. And that really put a twist on it. It is so true. You know, I can have all this faith, but I've got to do the action. I've got to do the work. And then I have to leave the results up to God. You know, that's the part I forget, is between when I'm done with the footwork and leaving it up to God. That's the part I you know, tend to have trouble with. And the second part is on the top of page 20. And I do not quote the big book. Trust me, I'll say it wrong. I'm going to say it wrong right now. But it's the part, as you know, as ex-problem drinkers, our very lives are based on basically thinking of those and helping and who we can help, being of help to others. And that's, you know, that's what I was told. It says it in the big book. And so I'm going to continue to do it. And thank you for letting me share today.